Okay, one logistical note. I got an email from a student about the final exam, or sorry, the final project. Some of these links are dead. I'll rewrite it. I just didn't get a chance to upload the new version. But that will be fixed when I upload the lecture notes for this week as well. Okay, before we get started, is there any questions? Content from last week, logistics of the course, anything like that? Nope. Yeah.
For making two collisions, adjusted some calculation, it comes out to be 1, 1, 1. So is it the pitch decreases or it should increase for making it two collisions?
So in this case, if you So I want to be a little careful, so I'm going to correct your terminology. So collision actually means something slightly different. If you take that expected value and you change that number to 2, what you're expecting to see is that you'll be able to find 2 pre-images for that particular thing. So I guess technically maybe that is a collision. And so D should be much So you get 1, 1, 1 as in as opposed to sorry, like what's that in terms of D? Yeah.
And the possible number, minimum number of times will be need to calculate that comes to 2 to the power 1, 1, 1. So our question was whether the combination would decrease or it should increase to 1, 1, 3. If we want two images for the same hash function, whether the number n should increase or decrease.
So number n should increase. Right. Yeah, let me get back to you. I have to think about what that means exactly, what that number 2 means. Because if you want to calculate the probability of finding 2 pre-images, you need to change both the probability and that number 2. So the probability of finding 2 pre-images will no longer be 1 over 2 to the n, or 2 to the d, sorry. That probability would go up, or the denominator would go up, thus that number would go down. Therefore, you get a bigger number on the other side of the equation that you would have to compensate for. So just setting that equal to 2, I have to think about what the semantics of that equation actually means. What's that equation actually saying? I don't think it's saying what you think it's saying, which is that you want to find 2. And if you want to find a collision, yeah, anyways, okay. So basically, your question is what happens if you turn that 1 to a 2? Yeah, what does that actually mean? And then what does D do? So yeah, D is going to go down by half because that 2 you're going to divide off on the other side. So yeah, so if 112 will go to 111. And if you make it 4, it will go down by. Yeah, exactly. So there's no problem with your equation. It's just a question of what does that equation actually mean? What does that mean in expected value of 2? And I'm not sure what that means. It's not a really meaningful number, but yeah. So yeah, let me think about it. I'll maybe next class, if you remind me of the question, I'll answer it then. Yeah? Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Started. Okay, so just as a sort of recap, we're talking about these hash functions. A hash function takes a single input. Input can be any size. Another notation that we'll use that I didn't explain before looks like this. So in this notation, maybe I'll do it just as a little aside. Let's say we have a number, it's 3 digits long, and every digit, if it's a digit, that means it can be between 0 and 9. If it's a binary string, that can mean 0, 1. And so what we'll do is sometimes define the set of characters. Okay, so this can be a 0 or 1. This can be a 0 or 1. This can be a 0 or 1. And because there's three of them, if I wanted to denote this string, basically a 3-bit string, I'll denote it like this. So 0 or 1 for each character, and there's three of them. Okay, if I want to have a D-bit string, I'll denote this as D. Okay, and if I want to have an infinite string, for whatever reason, the notation that comes naturally to you would be to write maybe that, but mathematicians don't like that. They like to use a star in this particular case. So there's no strong reason for that. But anyways, a star here is basically the equivalent of an infinity. Okay, so this is just shorthand for this number comes from the set of infinite bits, binary strings. Okay. Thus, in this notation, the output is always D bits, so we can denote it as 0, 1, D. So that just it's a fancy way of saying it's a bit string that's D bits long. Okay, and we call this the output. The input we sometimes call the preimage or message. The hash function is the hash function. And as a reminder, it's deterministic. Meaning if you run it on the same input, same output, you'll always get the same. If you run it on the same input, you'll always get the same output. And everyone has the same copy of the hash function. Okay, so it's an open or public function. And I'm not denoting this especially for hash functions, like we're going to see later functions that are not this way. Every single function we talk about in this whole course will be deterministic, and it will be open public. We will play with determinism a bit. So we will look at functions that are random, but the way we'll denote them is we'll just pick a random number and we'll put it as an input to the function. Rather than saying the function itself is random, we just say, well, it takes this random input and it does something with it, okay? So actually, even though we talk about randomized functions, everything like capital before the brackets functions, they'll all be deterministic, okay? So there's nothing special about this. Okay, then we mentioned that hash functions have three properties. So last class we talked about preimage resistance. This class we'll talk about collision resistance. And a variant of collision resistance called weak collision resistance. And the sum total for preimage resistance, the result of our analysis is D has to be greater than or equal to 112 bits for preimage resistance, assuming hash is what we call a random mapping. In other words, there's no other defects in the hash function. The hash function behaves like normal. Okay? Okay, any questions so far? Okay. Okay, before we talk about collision resistance, I gave you a couple different conceptions or ways of thinking about what's going on here. Another one that's also useful is you can think of a hash output as a series of coin flips. Okay, so if we have D bits, so let's say I run the hash on some input X, never done it before, I have no clue what the output is. It's as if I just flipped the coin a certain number of times. How many times do I flip the coin? D times, okay, whatever the output of the hash is. Right, and if it's, for example, if it's heads, we could say that's a zero, and if it's tails, that's a one. Okay, and so if I ask you about pre-image resistance, basically what I do is I just write down heads, tails, tails, heads, tails, heads, whatever, some sequence, and then I ask you, okay, you're going to flip D coins. What's the probability that when you flip D coins, the sequence that you see matches my sequence? Okay? Yeah, and it's going to be 1 over 2 to the D. Okay? And then the alternative way of asking it is, how many times would you have to flip that set of D coins until your output matched my output on expectation? Okay? And then it's 2 to the D. Okay? Or 2 to the 112. Okay. So this might be useful in terms of collision resistance. Okay. So collision resistance, we'll abbreviate to CR. I'll just write down the definition, an informal definition. Okay, so it's infeasible to find any x in x prime where they're not equal, they're two different values. Remember, x in this case is the input to the hash function, such that the output is the same. Okay, so how is this different than pre-image resistance? I mean, they all kind of sound the same, right? Okay, so in this case, we don't care what the output is. Okay, for pre-image resistance, we're grinding out inputs until it matches a particular output. Okay, so in pre-image resistance, we care a lot about the outputs. We're looking for a property in terms of the outputs, namely that it matches some other output that we have. Here, we just care about the inputs. Okay, the output can be anything. It has to be the same. It has to have a property, but we're not looking for one particular output or not. Okay, so it is an actual different question that we're asking, okay? Now, what's your intuition say about how hard this is? Do you think this is harder or easier than pre-image resistance or exactly the same? Okay, so we don't like the idea that it's the same. If it were exactly the same, we probably wouldn't be having this course. I think I hinted at that in the last lecture. Okay, is it harder or easier? Do we have to try more values or less values? More values. Okay, so we think this is going to be a harder value. Okay, so let's see about that. Okay, so before we talk about this, I want to do a sort of aside on a kind of statistical problem that relates directly to this, and then we'll come back to this problem. Okay. Okay, so there's this thing that's known in statistics. It's called the birthday paradox, and it goes something like this. Well, let's take this room as an example. So there's lots of people in this room. What's the probability that two people in this room have the same birthday? Okay, that's the birthday paradox in a nutshell. Okay, and your intuition says, well, we know the probability of two people having the same birthday, any two people, is about 1 over 365, assuming birthdays are uniformly random, which we'll assume. And, of course, there's leap years and all that stuff. But just as a rough approximation, okay? And so another way of phrasing it, just slightly different, might be, how many people would you have to get in a room so that, you know, you'd have a 50% chance that two people have the same birthday, or a 99.9% chance, okay? And most, your intuition is probably thinking, well, it has to be around 365. Like, if we want to guarantee it's around 365, maybe a little bit less, okay? The reason this is called a paradox is because there's actually a sort of surprising counterintuitive result that number is a lot less than what you might think, okay? So, for example, in order to have a 50-50 chance that two people have the same birthday, you only need 23 people in a room, okay? And if you have 70 people in a room, which is a lot less than 365, you're basically guaranteed that someone's going to have it. 99.9% probability that two people are going to have the same birthday in a room where there's 70 people, okay? If you want to make money, go to a party where there's about 50 people, and then you can bet on it. And lots of people would probably take the other side of the bet. The odds are in your favor. It's not guaranteed, but the odds are very much in your favor, okay? So what's going on here? Why is this sort of counterintuitive? So let's think about it maybe graphically. So pretend we have, I don't know, 8 people. Okay, so here's our 8 people. And what you're thinking about is, you're probably thinking of a slightly different probability question, which is, if I walk into a room, what's the probability that one of you has the same birthday as me? Okay? So that's a different question than saying, what's the probability that any two people in the room have the same birthday? Okay? What's the probability that someone has the same birthday as me? Well, if I'm this person in the middle, it's going to be, I basically have, you know, 7 chances of getting a hit, okay? Someone that has the same birthday in this particular scenario, okay? So I have 7 chances, and each of my chances, the probability is, you know, 1 over 365, okay? Or in general, you can think of it as sort of P, probability P, okay? Now, this is in line with your intuition. You'd have to get about 365 people, then you would have 365 times 1 over 365, that's your expected value, then you would expect that one person would have a match, okay? But what we're asking, the question that we're asking is, what's the probability that any two people have it, okay? So what that means is that we're not including all the possible two people that could have a birthday, okay? So this is all the people that could have a birthday with me, right? But these two people could have a birthday. These two people could have a birthday. Okay, so we have to count up all the combinations of people that will have a birthday, okay? So let's take this person. They could match with this person, okay? This person could match with this person, this person, this person, this person, this person, this person could match with this person. Okay, so that's a little messy. I didn't mean to put any order on it. The point here is there's a lot more purple lines than there are green lines, right? And so when we open the question up to how many people have the same birthday as me to how many, you know, what's the probability that any two people have the same birthday, okay? The number of probabilities went up by a huge amount, okay? More than a linear amount, okay? It wasn't like it doubled or tripled. No, it went up by like a really big amount, okay? And the more dots that you get, the greater that effect is going to be, okay? So just to give you some numbers before we derive the general equation, So in this case, let's say we had seven other people besides us. If you count up the arrows, there were seven green arrows initially. Color code this. Okay, so green arrows, we had seven, okay? In terms of purple arrows, if you count them up, there'll be 15. And so that gives us a total of 21, okay? So we had 21 possible matches. 15 of them came from purple arrows, seven came from green arrows. If instead of seven, let's say we did like 99, okay, so we had 100 people. We would get 99 direct comparisons. Sorry, what should be 22? Sorry, down here, yeah. Yeah, my bad. Thank you. Okay. If we have 99, the number of purple arrows in this case, when we close all of them, would be 4849. Okay, and now I'm worried that this number doesn't add up. It would give a total of 4948 possible values. Okay, so the point is that the bigger your number of nodes, the bigger this effect of adding in all these purple arrows is going to be. Okay, so you can see this is a much bigger number than this. More than a linear amount, how much more? Is it double? Is it like a quadratic? We're not sure yet. Okay. Okay, so let's go back to hash functions, and we'll keep this property in mind. Okay, so what this is going to tell us is that finding collision should be a lot easier than finding pre-images, okay? Finding pre-images is kind of like doing this green arrow or this green line, okay? When we find collisions, any two can match, okay? And so it's going to be more like this purple line, okay? The purple plus the green, okay? And so as a result, what we're going to require is we're going to require our hash function, our D, to be much bigger than it was if we just want pre-image resistance, okay? So that's sort of where we're going, but let's reason through the math itself. Okay, so once again, we're going to assume the hash is a random mapping. And we're just going to find collisions through exhaustive search. So what does that mean? Basically, we'll pick a number, x, an input. We'll hash it. We'll write down the output. And we'll pick another number. We'll hash it. And we'll compare it to the output that we just wrote down. Okay? And if it matches, we're done. If it doesn't match, then we pick another input. we write it down, but now we have two numbers to compare it to, okay? And any one of those could give us a match, okay? Okay, so to just visualize what's going on, so I started with say all zeros. It's arbitrary means it doesn't matter how we do it. So this is going to give us a particular y value. Okay, then I might try the next possible value that will give me some other y. And then what I'm going to ask myself is, are these two values the same? Okay, and assuming, let's assume they're not the same, then we'll keep going. Okay, we'll keep writing down outputs. But the point is this one, it could be the same as this, or it could match with this one, okay? This one could match with this one, or it could match with this one, or it could match with this one, okay? So every time we do a new output, we have a whole list of things that it could potentially match, okay? So the more outputs that we do, the bigger our list gets, the higher our chances of matching it to something on the list are, okay? In other words, yeah, so the probability of finding a match is going to grow really, really quickly. It's not going to grow a linear amount where every time we try another one, we have another trial. It's like we add one, we get kind of like n trials if we've tried n so far. So we've tried 100 values, then we get 100 shots at getting a match. And the next time we get 101, okay? So what does this all add up to? Well, it adds up to a kind of quadratic probability, okay, where if you want to try 100 values, you're going to get 100 squared possible shots at matching, okay? So we'll derive this in the context of an actual collision. So the way we'll do this is exactly the same as we did for pre-image resistance. So the question we're asking is how many inputs do we have to try to see one collision? And we'll note it's on expectation. Okay. So the expected number of collisions is going to equal the number of chances and I just want to note that we don't know what this number is, but we're going to call it something, so we'll call it capital N like we did in the previous case. Okay, so it's going to be the number of chances times the probability that one chance is a match. Okay, so let's deal with these. So the number of collisions we want to find is, we want to find one, so that's fine. What's the probability that one chance is a match? In other words, we generate some y, what's the probability that this y and this y matches? Forget about how many green arrows there are. What's just the probability that there's a match? Okay, so it's going to be 1 over 2 to the whatever our output function is. We're going to keep it general, so we're going to say d. Okay, so that's the same as finding a pre-image. Okay, now what's different here is the number of chances. Okay, So let's say I spit out this value, okay? How many things can it match? N minus 1. So if it's the nth element, it can match N minus 1. Now, let's say we spit out 100 of these. How many comparisons do we make? So I write down 100 Y, and we're going to compare every Y to every other Y on the page. How many comparisons is that? Okay, so it's going to be how many pairs of Ys are there? Okay, so if I write down 100, right, I'm just asking how many pairs are there of 100 numbers, okay? Because I want to try every pair, okay? So it's going to be N choose 2, okay? So I have N elements, I write down 100, there's N choose 2 pairs, okay? And so it's going to be N choose 2. So I'll sort of draw this out too to try and convince you, right? So I have a bunch of outputs sitting on a page, and we'll say there's N of them, okay? This one could be a match, right? This could be a match. This could be a match. This could be a match. This diagram is going to get too messy, but you see the point, okay? So every possible pair could be a match. How many possible pairs are there? Well, it's all the ways of choosing two elements from N elements. Okay, so that's N choose two. Okay, any questions about that? Can you just say it louder? N choose two. So this is just a notation. If you're not familiar with it, it has a value which we'll write out, but there's no line or anything like that. Yeah. And sometimes it's also denoted by nom of N and two. So if you program, that's sort of how you would denote it in languages like Mathematica. Okay, so what's the question is, okay, what is N over 2? Or sorry, N choose 2. Okay, so this is what it equals exactly. So it's going to be N times N minus 1 over 2. Okay. Now all we do is we want to get a relationship between D and N. We want to know how big does D have to be in order to get N. We're going to set N to 2 to the 112 because that's what NIST says. So that's going to tell us what D is going to be. Okay. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to make some simplifications just because they don't really matter. So this is technically going to be N squared minus N over 2. I'll do the simplifications in the next line. Okay, taking away n from n squared is not, you're not taking off very much compared to n squared. So we can just consider that n squared. And once again, if we take half of n squared is not that much compared to n squared. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to replace this term with n squared as an approximation. Okay, we'll move this over to the other side. So we're going to get 2 to the d equals n squared. Okay, so what does n equal? Okay, so how do we get rid of the squared? We'll take this really slow, square root. Everyone who said log is wrong. Okay, so n over square root of d. Another way of writing square root is 2 to the d over 2.
So it should be minus d?
Positive, because we moved it over. Yeah. Okay. Okay, now, what's n and d? I mean, this is nice. We have this equation. We solved it for N and D. What are they again? Remind me. What's D? Okay. So D is the size of the output. And what's N? Okay. All right. So let's say that we want this to be secure. Okay? If we want it to be infeasible so that you can find it on expectation one, how big should N be? Okay, so 2 to the 112, okay? So if we want this to be secure, secure means infeasible to find a collision. I want you to try I want you to have to try 2 to the 112 possible inputs before you can expect to find a collision, right? If I can do that, then I'm guaranteed that you're not guaranteed, but you're not going to be able to find a collision in any amount of reasonable time, okay? So I'm going to replace N with 2 to the 112. So this is the same as we did in the previous example, okay? And if we get rid of the 2s, we see that 112 is equal to D over 2. So D is going to be double 112, okay? So what does this mean conceptually? Okay, so we have to double the size of the hash output in order for it to be secure against collision-resistant attacks, or in order for it to be collision-resistant, okay? So like we said, it's a lot easier to find collisions than to find pre-images. And the longer the output of your hash is, the more secure it is against both attacks, okay? And so if we want collision resistance, we got to get D up to 112. If we want pre-image resistance, sorry, we have to get it up to 112. But if we want collision resistance, collisions are way easier to find. So 112 is not enough. We can't stop at 112. We have to keep going, and we have to go up to at least 212 bits, okay? Then we can have both properties. So if you think of a line, right, and this is D equals 1, the smallest hash function, something interesting happens when we cross over to D equals 112, and then something else is going to happen that when we cross over to D equals 224, okay? So any hash function in this range is not going to be pre-image resistant, and it's not going to be collision resistant either, okay? Once we get D above 112, we have pre-image resistance, okay? But we don't have collision resistance, okay? And once we get above 224, then we're going to have both pre-image resistance and collision resistance, okay? So collision resistance, easier to find collisions, therefore harder to design your property, your hash function against it, okay? So pre-image resistance, from the perspective of the designer, it's a weaker property. Weaker is in the sense it's easier to achieve, okay? Any old hash function can achieve PR, but it has to be extra special to achieve CR. That's sort of where that terminology weak comes from, okay? So that's relevant to the next property, which is weak collision resistance. Some papers or textbooks use a different term for this, so they call it second pre-image resistance. I prefer weak collision resistance because there's a relationship between this and collision resistance. There is actually no relationship other than it kind of looks like the same problem between second pre-image resistance and pre-image resistance itself. Okay. Okay. So this says it's infeasible if I give you an input X to find some other input that's not the same, such that the hashes are the same, okay, such that you have a collision. Okay. So this property is more like, what's the probability that someone has the same birthday as me? My birthday is X, so I'm given a particular value. Now I have to find another value that matches. Okay? As opposed to collision resistance, where you get to choose either of these two values. Okay? And by choosing either of these two values, when you're doing exhaustive search, you have lots of possible matches. Here, all we can do is keep generating XIs until it happens to match this particular X. Okay? That's the best that we can do. Okay? So this turns out to be basically the same as pre-image resistance. It's the exact same map. You just keep generating this value until it happens to come out to this particular value here. So I'm not going to derive the math for this one. We'll sort of take it as a stated fact. It's a less important property. Okay, and so if we go up to our chart here, we can add it in. So it's going to behave the same as PR. Okay, so once we get above 112, we get both PR and weak collision resistance. But we don't get the strong version of collision resistance until we get up above 224 bits. Okay, that's why it's called weak, is because you get it earlier than you get actual collision resistance. Okay, now, yeah, there's so few examples of weak collision resistance that there won't be an emphasis on it. We'll concentrate more on just CR and PR itself. Okay. Okay. Any questions about this? Yeah, so in PR, let's go up. So I guess I didn't write it. I have it in last year's notes, or last class's notes, which are last year's notes. Okay, so in pre-image resistance, what we're given is an output, Y. And then we have to find one X that will hash to that particular Y, okay? In weak collision resistance, we're given an input as opposed to an output. But since that input hashes to an output, you can almost think of it as being given an output, okay? That's not substantially different. But the difference here is when you go into your exhaustive search, you have both an input and an output, okay? In pre-image resistance, you just have an output. Okay, now let's say you have an algorithm that's super good at finding pre-images. Okay, so you broke in some hash function and it will find some pre-image for you. Okay, you can go and break pre-image resistance because you're given an output, you'll run your algorithm and then it will give you an input and then you're done. Here you might get caught because maybe you run your algorithm and it gives you an input, but the input turns out to be the one that you were given in the problem statement. Okay, so then you have to go and find another input. Okay, so that's the only difference between the two of them. That's like a very technical point that doesn't really matter. But what it shows is that if you have a black box that breaks this property, you can't use it to break pre-image resistance and vice versa. Okay, so that's sort of where we're going now, is that the two problems are separate. Okay, so a solution to this problem won't give you a solution to the other or vice versa. Does that clear it up? Yeah, okay, perfect. Yeah, no problem. So the question is basically, what's the difference between WCR and PR? Okay, why don't we write it up? Okay. So in PR, you're given an output, you find an input. Here you're given an output, you find an input, but you're also given an input that it can't be. Okay? So in other words, when you find your input, there's a restriction on it, which is that it can be any input that's a preimage of Y, except for this one I gave you. Okay? So it's a slightly more restrictive form of PR. So if I have an algorithm that does this, where I give Y's and it spits out an X, I can run it on this Y, but it might accidentally spit out the same X that I was given, and that one's not allowed, right? So my algorithm that breaks this won't necessarily break this property.
So yeah. Why were you telling that it's the same thing?
Yeah, so the exhaustive search. So another way of breaking it is just through exhaustive search. And through exhaustive search, the runtime of breaking this and breaking this will be the same. Yeah. Okay.
So,
yeah.
For the collision is, if you want to have two inputs that have the same hashes,
yeah.
Probability will change. The number of hashes that we have to compute, does it increase or decrease?
So it will increase. So what you're talking about is finding what's called a multi-collision. It will increase, but not by as much as you would expect. Okay, so the thing about multi-collisions is finding the first collision is really hard, and then finding three collisions, four collisions, five collisions become easier relative to the amount of work that went into solving the first one. So there's a sort of counterintuitive result. There is a general formula that you can write down. Instead of 2d equals n squared, there's a more general one that takes into account the number of collisions that you want in a multi-collision. I forget it off the top of my head, but if you look at the assignment from last year, that was one of the questions on the assignment, was to write down that formula for multi-collisions. Yeah. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
Just to clarify, do you need actually, like, what's the size of the output? Like, so how many possible each box you can try, right? Like from 0 to 9, for example?
Yeah. Well, no, so D will be the number of boxes that you have. Yeah, yeah. And in each box, it will either be 0 or 1, so we're only talking binary. Yeah. And therefore, the number of outputs will be 2 to the D. Does that make sense? Yeah. So D bit string gives you 2 to the D possible values.
There's two possibilities for every output.
Yeah, exactly. So you'll do 2 times 2 times 2 d times, which is 2 to the d. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, the final thing is just sort of a curiosity. Feels really important to me to, you know, prove to you that we're not wasting your time. And so if one of these properties implied the other, then why talk about all of these properties, okay? So one reason that we're not talking about weak collision resistance that we sort of glossed over is once you have collision resistance, then you get weak collision resistance. Okay, so why is this the case? So if we have if we have collision resistance, that means it is infeasible to find any two hashes, okay? So you can't find any collision between any two values. If we have weak collision resistance, we can't find it in this special case where it matches some X prime. Well, this is a collision, right? So if you can find a weak collision resistance. If you can break this property, then you found a collision as well, okay? So if you can resist all collisions, you can also resist collisions where one of the two values is chosen for you, okay? Okay, so having CR implies WCR, so we don't really talk about WCR. We'll never talk about a hash function that's only WCR and not CR itself, okay? That only has the weak property and not the strong property, okay? But what about preimage resistance? Okay, does PR imply CR, or maybe vice versa? Does having CR imply PR? So first off, is it possible to have a hash function that's pre-image resistant but not collision resistant? Okay, what's an example? In general, like not the name of one, but a property. Okay, so let's say we have a D that's exactly 112 bits. Okay, in that case, it is pre-image resistant, but it's not big enough to be collision resistant. Okay, so all hash functions in this range, right, they all are pre-image resistant and not collision resistant. Okay, so it can't be the case that once you're pre-image resistant, you're automatically collision resistant. Okay, what about vice versa? So we know CR is a harder property to achieve. So if we go all the way to achieving CR, does that imply that we also solve PR? Okay, so it's reasonable to think it does, okay? But it turns out that it doesn't, okay? So in order to prove that it does, what we do is we kind of write down a really stupid design of a hash function that's purposely stupid. We call it a pathological design that is going to have, in this case, it's going to be collision resistant, but it's not going to be pre-image resistant. You would never ever use this hash function. It's just to prove that in theory, you can write down the description of a hash function that would have this property, okay? Okay, so let's assume we do have a secure hash function, okay? Secure in this case means it's both PR and CR, and of course if it's CR, it's also WCR, okay? So we have this hash function and it's secure. What I'm going to do is I'm going to design a new hash function using H. We'll call it H prime. Okay. So what I'm going to do is my new hash function is going to take X, it will return Y. Just like any other hash function. One small thing is it's going to be a little bigger than H. So H will spit out D bits. This is going to spit out D plus 1 bits, which is fine. If you recall, the definition of a hash function is just that it has a fixed output size. It doesn't matter what it is. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take the hash of X using my secure hash function, and I'm going to put a 1 in front of it. Okay, And I'm going to spit that out in some cases. Okay, in most cases, this is what I'm going to do. So I'm just going to take the hash of x, I'll prefix a 1 to it, and then that's going to be my new hash function. Okay, now, just before we get too far, if h of x is secure, is h prime of x secure if all I do is put a 1 in front of it? It has to be secure, right? If it wasn't secure, then every time you see the output of a hash, you could just put a 1 in front of it, and then you could break the hash function. Okay, so this isn't doing anything at all. Okay, so this, whenever this gets executed, it's going to be both PR and CR. Okay, now what I'm going to do is, in special cases, I'm going to do something really stupid, because remember, I'm trying to make this hash function so it's not pre-image resistant, so it's easy to find pre-images, okay? So in some cases, what I'm going to do is, I'm just going to spit out the value of x itself. So whatever the input is, I'm going to make that the output of the function. I'm going to put a 0 in front of it just to distinguish it from this case. And specifically, I'm going to do it when the size of x equals d. Okay, so remember, you can hash anything of any size. So what I'm saying is, pretend this is a 256-bit. Pretend this h, the non-prime version of h, is SHA-256. SHA-256 has 256 bits. Okay, so if I come along with an x that's smaller than 256 bits or bigger, then I'm just going to hash it with SHA-256 and spit out a 1. That's obviously both pre-image resistant and collision resistant. Okay, if it's exactly the same, if it's exactly 256 bits, I'm going to return the input as the output. Is that pre-image resistant? No, right? Because you know what the input was given the output. Okay, so if you look and you say, hey, here's an output of a hash function, it's 0 and a 256-bit value, what was the input? The input was that value once you scrape off the 0. Off the front, okay? So this is not pre-image resistant whenever you get into this clause. Is this collision resistant? Just this top line.
Yes.
Yes, why?
It's only one.
Okay, so every different x will give you a different x here. It's an identity function, right? So if my input's 1, my output's 1. If my input's 2, my output's 2. So for every 256-bit value, there's exactly the same 256-bit value here. So every unique input has a unique output, okay? So it is CR, okay? So in other words, this whole hash function is CR. It doesn't matter what happens in terms of the size of x. It's CR in both cases. Okay. Here it's even stronger, right? Collision resistance, remember, it says it's infeasible to find collisions. Here there are no collisions, right? It's actually impossible, just on this top clause. Okay, but that's a small point. But the difference here is that whenever I come along with inputs here that are exactly 256 bits, it's not pre-image resistant, okay? So if it's not pre-image resistant some of the time, so most of the time it is pre-image resistant, but some of the time it isn't, what do we say about the whole hash function? Is the whole hash function pre-image resistant or not? The answer is no, okay? As long as there's at least one case where it's not pre-image resistant, then the whole thing's not pre-image resistant, okay? So this whole thing is a hash function that's not pre-image resistant, but is collision resistant, okay? So once again, this is a completely theoretical design just to prove in theory that it is possible to have something that's CR but not PR, Okay? So this whole construction is just to say that, that CR does not imply PR. Otherwise, this hash function could not exist. Okay? But it could clearly exist. Therefore, that implication has to be true. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah. So in this case, remember this isn't proving anything about the size of D. So in this case, we're just saying that when X happens to equal D, we're going to do something different than when it doesn't equal D. Does that answer? Or? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Don't worry about this. I'm not going to put it on an exam. But it's, like I say, what you should know is this. What are the key takeaways from all of this stuff that we're doing? This is the big takeaway, right, from all those equations that we wrote down, right? It's that you have to get D double what you think it should be in order to get collision resistance because the birthday paradox is way faster than you expect. And then the other big takeaway is that just because you have pre-image resistance doesn't imply collision resistance and vice versa. Okay, let's talk about a few real hash functions. Okay, so MD5 is a hash function. It came out in 1992. SHA-1 came out in 1995. They were sort of standardized by different people working on hash functions. SHA-1 came out with two variants. We'll talk about the difference. It came out in 2001. And most recently in 2015, we standardized SHA-3. Okay, where do hash functions come from? So MD5 was developed by Ron Rivest. He's like the RNRSA, which is an algorithm that we'll talk about later, very famous algorithm. And he sort of did it for his company, RSA. SHA-1, I believe, was standardized by NIST. NIST is the standards and technology, the same people that say you should use 2 to the 112. And then they got kind of in the business of standardizing hash functions. Okay, so they standardized SHA-2, and then most recently they standardized SHA-3. Okay, and this is just a few years ago that they came out with SHA-3. SHA-3 you might not find in every cryptographic library that you'll use because it's so new, though you should start to see it now more often than not. SHA-2 you'll see everywhere. SHA-256, as far as we know, is completely secure. There's no issue with it. SHA-1 was starting to break. Okay, and because it was starting to break, then people started working on SHA-3 because we got nervous that once SHA-1 started to break, then it wouldn't be long before people would start to break SHA-256. Okay, now what does this mean? It means, I said, it starts to break. What does that mean? So we'll talk about this in a little more detail when we look inside the hash function. But essentially what people will do is they'll start by trying to find collisions because collisions are way easier than pre-images, okay? So at first you have the naive algorithm, which is exhaustive search. We can write down how hard it is just based on the output size alone. But then what we'll do is we'll start to question whether these are actually random mappings. Because if there's any biases in terms of how it maps inputs to outputs, we might be able to do way faster than exhaustive search. Okay? And so that's what tends to happen. So what will happen is, for example, in MD5, people will find, they won't find a full collision. They'll find a what we call partial collision, where lots of the bits match, but maybe not quite all of them. Okay? And someone will find a big partial collision, and then the next year another cryptographer will find one that's even bigger, and eventually someone will publish the first collision. Okay? Then once they publish the first collision, that's fine. I mean, it's two random numbers that happen to have the same hash. What we'd really like to do is we'd like to, you know, take the hash of a file and then compute like a malware version of the file and have them come out to the same hash. So we want a meaningful collision. So then they'll work on, you know, finding meaningful collisions, okay? So MD5 is broken to the fact that to the extent that not only can you find a collision, like just two random numbers, you can find these meaningful collisions. So you can actually make two certificates that hash the same thing, or two files that hash the same thing, okay? But no one has published a preimage to MD5, okay? So no one's broken the preimage resistance of that function yet, okay? SHA-1 recently, collision resistance was broken, and then SHA-2 through to SHA-3 are still secure, as far as we know. Okay, so in terms of the output size, MD5 had a 128-bit output. SHA-1 had 160, and then, as these names imply, they have 256 and 512, respectively. Okay, so as far as we know, preimage attacks are not possible on any of these algorithms. Yeah?
Are there any use cases to still use MD5? Or it's like you use your old Windows XP OS?
Yeah, so MD5 was still used, as of a couple of years ago, you could still use it like online if you connect to a website over SSL that lock appears, you could see MD5 used in that context. I'll show you later. I think Concordia even still allows MD5 to be used, which is really, really poor. But then the question is, does it matter? So it depends on the application. So for some applications, you actually don't care about collision resistance at all. You only need pre-image resistance. And so if you only need pre-image resistance, I'll give you an example later, but it's like if you're storing passwords, for example. If you store passwords, you don't need collision resistance. No one cares about it. So in that case, it's fine. You can use MD5. You don't have to phase it out. But cryptographers were really nervous, okay? We're paranoid, right? And so as soon as one algorithm starts breaking, and because you can find collisions now, we think it's not far off that you'll find pre-images. So as soon as there's any sort of cracks in the security of them, we switch really fast and we build bigger things, okay? So you should not ever use MD5. If you really, really know what you're doing and it's like you don't want to upgrade some legacy system and you really know that you don't care about collision resistance, you know, you still should switch. But anyways, yeah, you could technically not switch. Yeah?
I built the database includes some normal very popular password here, but
yeah.
Then I calculate up the MD5, and then maybe we can find the password.
Right, you mean
so,
using a rainbow table?
Yes, can you call it pre-image resistant?
Let's come back to that question. So I'll give passwords as the exact example, and so that's a really good point, which is if your pre-image resistance is only as secure as the sort of unknown you have about the actual inputs. So yeah, let's circle back to it because I have that as an example coming up. Yeah. Okay. What about collision resistance? Okay, so we stated collision resistance in the one direction where I said, you know, it has to be twice as big as you think. Okay, now we're going to state it in the opposite direction. I'm going to ask you, how much work would it be just through exhaustive search to find a collision if D is 128 bits? Okay, it's going to be half, right? So it's going to be 64, okay? So MD5 only has 64 bits of collision resistance. Okay, how much work is that? 2 to the 64. Can you do 2 to the 64 today? Yeah, you can, actually. You could do it on a computer, okay? So it's not even in that sort of range where it's kind of like we're not comfortable with it, but it's still not possible. No, you could actually just exhaustively search it. Now, MD5, you can also, there's structural defects, and so you can do a lot faster than that naive exhaustive search, okay? But even naive exhaustive search is fine for collision resistance, okay? So it's not collision resistance. So naive collisions take 2 to the 64. Why 64? Because it's half of 128, okay? So whenever you see a hash function, you're like, okay, that's 256 output. That means it only has 128 bits of collision resistance, okay? All right. So these guys are all going to be fine because 128 is above 112. 160 is going to give us how much collision resistance? 80 bits. Is 80 more than 112? No. Can you do 2 to the 80? You can't really. I mean, that's kind of at the threshold, okay? You probably can't do it. But SHA-1 also has some structural defects, and so someone was recently able to find collisions in this, not using the exhaustive search method, but using structural defects, okay? I'll just note that this is only 80 bits of CR. So this is different ways of kind of saying the same thing. We might say it takes 2 to the 80 work, or we'll say, oh, it has 80 bits of security. So you should get comfortable with all these different ways of expressing the same concept. Yeah?
So when is the 112-bit guideline
up? Like, when will they up that?
When did it come out?
So the 112 was in, that's a good question. I think it was in the early, mid-2000s. I forget, but they periodically, like maybe once every 5 or 10 years, they'll update that document. And they do say, they have different classes. So they're like, if you really want your thing to have like a 40-year horizon or 20-year horizon, then maybe 112 isn't enough. Maybe you should double it and go to 224. So they kind of have different, it's not just as simple as 112, but anyway, that was for the sake of teaching a course, I just pulled out the simplest case, which is 112. Yeah, so that document itself, I should put a link to it on the course website. It's called, like, I forget even what it's called, the NIST, yeah, Guidelines for Cryptographic Parameters or something like that. Okay, other questions? Yeah, exactly. So because people, even before we found collisions in it, we had a better version already, which is SHA-2, plus we were working on SHA-3, and then people started finding partial collisions, and so we knew it was like getting really, really close. And so there was a big push about 1 or 2 years ago to get SHA-1 wiped off of SSL and TLS and some other cryptographic standards. Yeah. So right now it's almost universally gone. Yeah.
Given the SHA-384, does it fall on the SHA-3 or SHA-2?
So which, this one? Or this one?
There's another one called 384.
Oh, 384, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, it would be in between here. Yeah, so maybe I didn't include all of them. These are the two standard ones that you see most often. If there's a 384, it will be in both SHA-2 and SHA-3. What they did is when they designed SHA-3 is they said, we want it exactly the same as SHA-256 in terms of the output, but it should be faster. More secure with less space. And then there's another problem that all three of these functions have, which is called a life extension attack, which we'll talk about next, that SHA-3 doesn't have because they redesigned how it works. But before we talk about that, we have to look inside what a hash function looks like. Another thing, just out of curiosity, is how does SHA-3, like who decides it? How does it come into being? So what happens is NIST will announce, hey, we want a new SHA. Okay, we want SHA 3. And so they'll have a competition. So they'll say, anyone, you know, you could, if you wanted, submit a design for a hash function. So they'll get, you know, 20, 30 designs. And then they'll have, like, kind of a competition where the designers or other cryptographers attack all of the designs. And they try and find collisions or pre-image resistance or try to put, or conversely, try to prove that it doesn't have those particular attacks. And they'll try and put numbers on things. And then they'll kind of whittle it down to like four or five designs, and they'll be the finalists. And usually the last four or five designs are all secure. There's no issue with them. It just comes down to performance. Some will be good in software, some will be good in hardware. Things that are good in software aren't necessarily good in hardware, and vice versa. Some will consume more power than others. And so they have like a really fine-grained sort of scoring. And then eventually they'll pick one design and say, okay, this one wins, and so this one's going to become SHA-3. We'll now call this design SHA-3 from now on, okay? So that's how SHA-3 comes into existence. So they announced the winner in 2015, but the process of like actually starting to pick it started many years earlier, like probably around 2010 or something like that.
Does that mean it was never meant to be a replacement of SHA-2?
So it is meant as a strict replacement of SHA-2. So SHA-2 itself was selected through a similar process, although they sort of fine-grained the process since. But yeah, so SHA-3 is spec'd to be exactly the same. Like any application that you have that you're using SHA-256, you should be able to drop in SHA-3 256. And the only thing that will happen is your security will get better and it will be faster. Yeah. Or at least not any slower for the increase in security. Okay, other questions, comments? Okay, so I'll walk through some applications, and then when we're done with the applications, then what we'll do is we'll zoom in on what a hash function looks like on the inside. We'll take note of a kind of defect in its design, its high-level design, and then I'll also just show you the low-level design of a hash function, not because I expect you to memorize it, but just because, you know, it wouldn't be a complete course if I don't show you what it actually looks like on the inside, okay? But before we jump over to applications, let's take a 10-minute break. So why don't you come back at 7:15? All right, we'll get started again. All right, so we spent a long time talking about hash functions, pre-image resistance, collision resistance. What does this all mean? Why is it actually useful? That's what we'll talk about next. So I'm going to give you a bunch of applications, and they're going to require different properties of hash functions. So the first one I promised already is password storage. Okay, so let's say we have a server, whatever, Gmail, and Alice comes along and she signs up with Gmail. So what that means is when she registers, she sets a password called PW. And then what Google can do in the back end, so they're going to do something a little more sophisticated than this, but just as a first attempt, they can have this kind of password table. So they'll say, okay, we have this new user, Alice, and this is her password. And the most basic property that you want is just that when Alice comes back later and says, hi, I'm Alice, and she submits some password that may be the same or it may be different, right? Maybe it's the right one, maybe it's the wrong one, then Google needs a way of saying, yeah, that's right or not. So what does it do? It goes in the database, it pops out this password, and it asks whether the password that was just supplied matches the password in the database, okay? Now, what's the problem of just keeping all your passwords stored in a file like this if you're Google sitting on a server? Okay, so, all right, so your administrators can see the passwords, so that's legitimate. What else? So technically, your administrator can probably see your email anyways. They probably could just go directly into your email with or without your password. Sorry? An adversary. Okay, so if someone hacks in and they dump this password table, then everyone's password's gone or compromised. Does that ever happen in real life? Yeah, it happens all the time, right? It's always in the news. So such and such a site got hacked. Okay, so what can we do that's a little better than just storing passwords like this? Okay, so we just talked about hash functions, so naturally we might think about a hash function. So what are we going to do with a hash function? How's it? What problem is that going to solve for us? Okay. So it's going to hide the password. So why do hash functions hide passwords? Okay, we're getting too sophisticated. Let's just go to basics. Okay, so what exactly are we going to hash? Okay, so we're going to hash the password itself where? Like, I'll give you three places. Do we hash it here? Do we hash it here? Do we hash it here? Okay, lots of different answers. Let's just write down the issue. Okay, so if we hash the password, say Alice hashes it before she sends it, what does that accomplish? Nothing really. It just changes her password. Her password is now the hash of her password instead of her password being her password. Okay, it's still some password. So that doesn't particularly do anything. What if in the table all the passwords were hashed? Okay, and in particular, let's think of the issue. So, you know, someone breaks in and they paste bin dump this file, and now they're all hashed. What does that mean? Can you log in as someone else other than you? No, because you know the hash of the password. If you submit the hash of the password, Google will take it. They'll hash the hash of the password and see if it matches. It doesn't match. Okay. Can you get the original password from the hash of the password? Okay, so pre-image resistance seems to imply no, right? So let's just categorize this for now. Okay. Okay. And then the final thing is, remember, we still have to do this check. Right? So now we have a hash of a password sitting here, but the person's coming back with a password. So how do we do this check? Okay, so we just hash it. If it's the same, what happens? If these two passwords are the same, what can we say about the hash of these two passwords? They're the same as well. Why are they the same? Because it's a deterministic hash function. Okay? So what we'll do is we'll take this password, we'll hash it, and then we'll do the comparison itself. Okay? So we can just sort of draw this out. So we'll still submit a password, and then what Google will do is they'll store h of password, okay? Then when Alice comes back later with some candidate, okay, what Google's going to do is they're going to hash that candidate, okay? And they're going to ask, is that equal to this value that I have stored? Call this y. Is it equal to this y? Okay, and Google doesn't even know what your password is anymore. So they knew it initially, and then they hash it, and then they can forget about it. Okay, so they don't care. Okay, and they don't need to know it. All right. Now what we're saying is, okay, so adversary comes along. So our adversary comes along, and they're able to dump this table. Sorry, we'll draw devil horns, whatever. Okay. Okay. Can they guess the password? Okay. So the answer is They can't do it directly because H is pre-image resistant. Okay. In other words, by looking at H of PW, I don't know what PW is. Okay. So what if you use dog as your password? D-O-G. Are you telling me that there's no way I could ever know that dog was your password? What if I just guessed and I said, let's say I thought that dog was your password. Could I confirm whether dog is your password or not? I can, right? So I could just hash dog, see what that value comes out. Hash functions are deterministic. They're public, right? So there's nothing stopping me from hashing it, and I can see whether it matches or not, okay? So pre-image resistance, it says there's no direct way to, given the output of a hash, to find its input. But if you got some guesses as to what the inputs are, you can test them out and see if they match, okay? So it doesn't actually stop a sort of exhaustive search on the password itself. Okay, so pre-image resistance is sort of good, but it's not a silver bullet, okay? It doesn't protect weak passwords, okay? All it does is it makes sure that your password, the only way of cracking your password, there's no direct way to crack it from the hash. I have to guess your password, okay? And so now it's a question of how fast can I guess your password, and that's going to have a lot to do with how you choose your password, okay? So what can we do to sort of stop this? Okay, is there anything we can do that's even better than this in particular? Okay. So these are ideas that we'll have. Before we get there, though, actually, let's think about what an adversary could do. Another thing, so the question is, okay, how can you implement this attack? So you break into whatever, Google, and you see that Google's using SHA-256, very secure hash function. It's pre-image resistant, plus collision resistant, which you don't need. And now you have a bunch of hashes of passwords, okay? And you want to break into someone's account. You find their account. You have the hash. How do you actually break it? So what you can do is you can start guessing passwords, right? So you could download a dictionary. You could use software like Johnny the Ripper. And you could, you know, which what it's called. And you could, you could go through and guess it, okay? But the thing is that when you do all that work of, say, taking a dictionary of known passwords and computing the SHA-256, anyone else who has a password list that has SHA-256, you're just repeating the same work that they already did, okay? Or they would do the same work that you already did. So what you could do instead is one person, somewhere, could get a very big dictionary of words, compute all the SHA-256 hashes of those words, and then just upload it on BitTorrent. Right. So now, instead of you having to go through all the work of hashing, you know, millions and millions of words, you just download this file, control F, look for the hash. And if it matches one of the things that was done, then you find it. OK, so that BitTorrent file thing we call a rainbow table. OK, so it's just a set of hashes of common passwords. And the point is, it just takes one time effort to create that. OK. Okay, so we are never going to solve this problem, okay? If you use dog as your password and I know what the hash function is, I can always try dog, okay? But we can solve this problem of one person does it for like the whole world, okay? How can we solve it? Well, if every hash function was different, so if Google used a slightly different hash function than Microsoft that used a slightly different hash function than LinkedIn, then the table that you built for Google is not going to work on Microsoft and it's not going to work on LinkedIn, okay? What would be even better is imagine if you could change the hash function for every single person in your database. So when Alice stores her password, you use one hash function, and when Bob stores it, you use a different hash function, and you basically use a different hash function for every single person within every single service, and every service is using unique passwords. So there's unique passwords all around. Then you can't build this one table that's going to work on everything, okay? Basically, you can still attack it, but you have to do the work yourself of running a dictionary through a hash function, okay? And that involves computing millions and millions of hashes, which does take some amount of time. It's not insignificant in terms of the amount of time, okay? So how can we tweak a hash function so that it's unique or individualistic? Okay, so we want to take a random... Okay. And... Okay, and where do we want to add it? Yeah, so it's called salt. Like, we add it in the description of the hash function, or we can actually just add it to the input of the hash function. Okay? So what we can do is, if we want a unique hash function, instead of hashing X, okay, our password, what we'll do is we'll take password and we'll concatenate, it doesn't matter, you can put it at the start or the end, doesn't make a difference, we'll concatenate some random number. Okay, and so this random number we call a salt. So I'll write it as salt and then describe it as a random number. And as long as we choose a different number, it doesn't even have to be random, it needs to be unique. As long as we choose a different number for each user, then you can't build a table because your table is going to be hashes of passwords, okay? You could build a table for the hashes of passwords with salt 1, okay? But that only works for the user that has their password with salt 1, okay? For the user where their salt is 2, that table doesn't work, okay? You'd have to recompute it from scratch, okay? Now, the final thing we need to do is a little sanity check is, okay, so I come along, I have my password. Now I generate a random salt, so I store the hash of the password in the salt. Then I come back and I have, you know, I'm logging in, I'm saying this is my password. What do I do here? What do I compare it to? Okay? If I take the hash of this new password, right, it's not going to match because I didn't include the salt. Okay? So I have to include the salt the second time, but how do I know the salt? Okay, so we're going to store it. Okay? And so I want to be very clear that what you're storing is you're storing the hash of the password and the salt, and you're storing the salt right beside it, and the salt is not a secret, okay? It's not like some secret that you have to protect. All it is just something that makes this hash function unique, okay? So if I dump this database, I get the hash of the password concatenated with the salt, and I get the salt too. It's sitting there as well, okay? So the only thing the salt is doing is, first off, you might say, well, what if it was secret? If it was secret, that's great. But if we had a way of keeping our salt secret, why don't we just store our passwords wherever we're storing our salts, right? If we have a super secure way of storing salts, then let's just store our passwords there, and then we don't have to have this discussion, okay? So this is all premised on the assumption that this thing's going to get dumped, okay, at some point. So your salt is not a secret. All it's doing is saying, if you can't, you're not going to download a rainbow table off of BitTorrent for this particular salt value because there's way too many of them, okay? And so our salts are usually, you know, you can think of them as, like, say, a 128-bit random number, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Correct. So the question is, what is the rainbow table itself? So the rainbow table is going to be the hash of dog, right? Yeah. Now maybe this person's password actually is dog, but the hash of dog with 5 at the end is going to be different than the hash of dog with 6 at the end. It's going to be different than the hash of dog with 7 at the end, right? So I need to have a rainbow table for this particular salt value. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay, so that's what it stops. So it doesn't stop me from guessing dog. So I can go through and try cat, dog, fish, right, with this salt value because I know the salt value, it's sitting there, but I have to do that work. So if my dictionary has 10 billion words, I have to compute 10 billion hashes as opposed to just downloading a file where I don't have to compute a single hash. Yeah, so it's only solving this one narrow problem. Yeah. It's being stored because there's no way to match if you don't have it. So there's no way that when the person comes back the second time, you have to compute whether the hash of this matches the hash of this, right?
If the user provides the password and the salt.
If the user keeps the salt, then the salt is just a password, right? It's some secret that only the user knows that they have to cough up every time they go to the site. So it's another word for a password in that configuration. It does, yeah. Yeah, so it's unique whether the website stores it or the user stores it. It makes it more secure in the sense that, yeah, it's a password, but then you get into all this problem of where are you going to store it? So I'm going to store it in my browser. So I have a Gmail password and it's on my computer, the salt, but now I want to log into Gmail from my phone or from the library computer, and I don't have that salt value, right? So then what am I doing? Am I memorizing the salt value? Well, if I'm memorizing it, then it's just a password, right? It's just, you're calling your password a salt or some combination of a salt and a password. And if you don't memorize it, you don't have this synchronization issue. Yeah, so there's literally nothing you can do better than just storing the salt on the server itself. Yeah. Yeah, so the idea here is, let's write this down, is we're going to make it unique for every password that you store. So for every user, so Alice comes along, you store her password with one salt, then Bob comes along, you store his value with a different value of salt. Yeah. That's the best. Now, some websites they'll do all sorts of stuff. Some will store in clear text, some will store unsalted hashes. Some of them will use a salt, but they'll use the same salt for the whole list. Some of them will use a unique per user salt. So per user is the best. It's not necessarily what's used. Yeah. Okay. Now what's this attack doing? Let's just go through it again. If you don't have the salt, you can download a dictionary. Okay? If you do have the salt, you're going to have to generate that dictionary yourself. Why is it worse to generate the dictionary yourself? It's because computing billions of hashes takes longer than downloading a file, okay? And so we want to make the adversary do as much work as possible, okay? Now, how long does it take to compute billions of hashes? Well, hashes are pretty fast, okay? But what if we use something that was slower than a hash? Like, let's say we had some, like, super slow hash function, okay? What that means is when I come along and log in, it's going to have to take the password I supply, hash it, and match it against the database. So that's going to be a little slower. Like, imagine, so hash functions, how fast are they? They take like nanoseconds, right, at this point, you know, if you have an ASIC or something like that. But let's say it took a whole second, or let's say it took 10 seconds to compute this hash, okay? That's a long time to wait to log in, but it's not that bad. Now you have a dictionary, and you have a billion words, and you have to compute a 10-second hash on all of them, that's going to take days, years to get through that dictionary, right? So if we could slow the hash function down, it is going to impact the user performance a little bit, but it's going to really impact the adversary because the adversary is trying to hash all the different possible combinations, okay? So that's the final tweak that we can do is we can slow the adversary down. And so the simplest way is instead of just hashing it once, we could hash it 1,000 times or some number of times, okay? Now, in practice, we don't want to slow it down so much, so 1,000 is like sort of typically the type of number that you would see, okay? So I'm going to denote it like this. That means apply the hash function 1,000 times. What does that mean 1,000 times? Well, it means hash it once, take the output, then hash the output again, and keep going 1,000 times. Okay, and now you've just slowed it down, and so now the salt makes the adversary have to do all the work themselves, and the slowing down makes them, the amount of work that they have to do take a lot longer than it should. Okay, so this is sort of the best thing, and there's a standard called PBKDF2. It doesn't even matter what it stands for, but it stands for password key derivation function. Version 2. Okay, and this is basically this, right? It's basically choosing a salt, hashing it a lot of times, and it's kind of has a few other bells and whistles, but that's something you can use. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So hashes are deterministic.
Yeah, and then it will be an issue on the memory.
It'll be an issue which?
With the memory. I mean, if we have to save all the hashes and the hash
work. Yeah, yeah. So, well, let's think about what it looks like. So, what you'll do is you'll take password, you'll put your salt. Oops. You'll put it through the hash function once. You'll get some output, right? Now you can actually throw away this value. You don't need it anymore. So then what you'll do is you'll take this output, you'll run it through the hash function again, and then you get this value, yeah? And so you'll just keep going. So at any given time, you just need the previous input or output, yeah? So I see your question now. So it's not a recursion in the sense that you're thinking of where you have to go back. It's more like a chain. Think of it as a chain of hashes. Yeah.
It's not like storing on that stack. It's keeping all that memory.
Yeah.
It's not doing that. It's just like keeping track of the previous one.
Yeah.
And then going from there.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like a loop as opposed. But all loops are recursions, and recursions can be written as loops. So, yeah. It is a kind of recursion, but not the kind that you're thinking that runs out of memory. Yeah. Just a loop. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, and then the other trick you can do if you really want to be clever is you can say, well, this server, you know, it's running usually just on commodity, you know, computer. And so computer has a lot of RAM, okay? But when people do brute force, they usually build special computers, or they'll use GPUs, for example, which are like a lot of parallel instances because you can search this stuff in parallel. But they don't have a lot of onboard memory. Or you could write a chip, like an ASIC, custom make a chip to brute force passwords, but it's not going to have any onboard memory either, okay? And so what you could do is, if your hash function required lots of memory accesses and it required a big state of memory that it had to keep in sort of play, then it would run just the same on a computer, but as soon as you switch to a GPU or an ASIC, it wouldn't run so well, okay? It wouldn't run at all. Okay, and so there are people who have looked at building these like sort of hash functions that are specific to computers. So there was even a competition in the style of NIST, like the way that they chose SHA-3 to choose a hash function specifically for this purpose. It was run a few years ago, and I don't remember reading the results of it, so I don't know if it's done yet, but it's called the password hashing competition or something like that. But one thing that is available today is called S-Crypt. And so S-Crypt is a way of storing passwords that has that property that you want. So it's easy to do on a computer, but it's really hard on a GPU or on an ASIC. So anyway, that's another tweak you could do in addition to all these tweaks. But in general, this is sort of the standard for how you would store passwords. Okay. Now, just to recap in terms of hash functions, so we care about pre-image resistance. What happens if pre-image resistance breaks? So let's say we have a password and it's trivial to find pre-image resistance, pre-images. How does this whole thing work? Doesn't work very well, because when we dump the list, then we'll just reverse the hash and then we'll get the password out. Okay. Now we might not get the right password, we might get a different pre-image. That's a sort of secondary point. Okay. But this requires free image resistance. What about collision resistance? What if we use a hash function here that wasn't collision resistant? Okay, so we could put in random passwords, and maybe one of these would collide with the real password, even though we didn't learn the real password. Is that an instance of weak collision resistance or strong collision resistance? Weak, because you're matching. So you're given something that you're matching, right? So in this case, yeah, weak collision resistance is something else we want. What about strong collision resistance? That basically says I can't go out and find two passwords that would hash to the same value. So what if I could? If I could, I mean, there's no attack there, right? Now I know two passwords. They happen to have the same hash. They have nothing to do with your passwords. And so collision resistance just isn't relevant to this particular problem. Okay? Okay. I'll give you another example. So this one I think I teased in the last one. So we can think of like file sharing, such as BitTorrent. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what we can do is that we could use double hash function.
Yeah, so you could mix up the hash function, but it's not going to net you any benefit. So why would it? So what problem would that solve? So you're adding complexity, a little bit of complexity, because you do have to swap things in and out. So if you're shooting for like the fact that you have to swap some code in and out of the computer, you could do that, but then you could just directly say, let's do a hash function that requires a lot of swapping. You know, like you can't keep the whole thing in memory at once or something like that. So there'd be more direct ways of sort of achieving what you want to achieve. Yeah. Okay. All right, so let's consider another example. So let's say we go and we, you know, we're going to download a pirated version of Photoshop off of the Pirate Bay or whatever you use now that the Pirate Bay is not that good anymore. Okay, and the key idea here is the actual Photoshop itself, you're going to download it from a bunch of random nodes on the internet, okay? And presumably, once you've downloaded your version of Photoshop, you're going to double-click on it and run it, okay? And if any of these like kind of chunks that you got from these random people on the internet happen to have, you know, sort of malware in it, well, now you're going to run the malware. Okay? So what you're going to end up with is you're going to have this file. Oops. Which is going to be kind of like chunk one, chunk two, chunk three, chunk four. Okay? So it's really dangerous to download applications from random people, right, and then run them, okay? So is there anything we can do to make that a little bit better? Okay, so what we could do is, let's assume that we trust the Pirate Bay. Okay, so this isn't the same to say that the person who uploaded the torrent, they uploaded a torrent that didn't have malware in it. We'll just assume that the voting mechanism or whatever it is on Pirate Bay, that works for that particular problem. Okay, all we care about is we do trust the Pirate Bay. The problem is we can't download the file from the Pirate Bay because they don't have the bandwidth to serve up all these files. Okay, they're not like mega upload, they're the Pirate Bay, right? They're just going to give us pointers to other people that we can get them from. Okay. So can the Pirate Bay do anything? Well, what they could do is, what if they sent us the hash of the file? This is a small number. It's only 256 bits long. Okay. Then we can download the chunks from all over the internet. And then we can hash all the chunks together. And then we can compare to whether it matches the thing we got from the Pirate Bay. Okay. And then if any of these chunks are malicious, then we'll throw it out And ideally, we would have a way to see which chunk was wrong. Otherwise, we'd have to re-download the whole thing. And so it gives you sort of more fine-grained hashes than just a hash over the entire file, okay? But that's the mechanism, essentially, that works inside a BitTorrent. So when you download that .torrent file, that's what's inside that .torrent file. Or if you download what's called a magnet link, it's in the URL of the magnet link itself. So let's say we get file prime here. Then we'll say, okay, is the hash of this file prime equal to the hash of the file that we're expecting? Okay, and there's no way to substitute in a fake file and have that hash come out to the same value. Why is that? Why couldn't you sit there and, I know I'm serving up chunk 3 to this person, right? I know what the hash should come out to be because I can go on the Pirate Bay and download what the hash should be, right? So why can't I stuff some malware into chunk 3 and have it so that the hash of this thing comes out to match the hash of this, even though the files themselves don't match? Weak collision resistance, okay? So the property of the hash function is that you shouldn't be able to find two inputs that match, okay? And in this case, it's the weak version because one of them is already specified. It's not enough to find two different chunks that just match each other. It has to match the chunk that's actually being served on the Pirate Bay, okay? Okay, the third example I'm just going to put in as a placeholder. We're going to come back to it later in the course when we talk about digital signatures. We're going to talk about something called hash and sign paradigm. And this is an example where you really require the strong version of collision resistance. Okay, so you want strong CR. You actually don't care about PR in this case at all. It doesn't matter whether you have it or not. But you do want CR in this particular case. Okay. So I know you haven't seen it, but what we have seen are sort of three examples. One where you want PR. Okay. One example where you really want weak collision resistance, and one example that we'll see later where you actually want strong collision resistance, and you don't really care about the other properties, okay? So all three properties are important. It depends on your exact application, which one you actually want. Yeah. Yeah, so it was PR and WCR, I guess, as well. Yeah. So in CR, so this is a good question. So why don't we care about CR in this case? So CR would mean that I could find any two chunks that hash to the same value, but that same value isn't going to be a value that's stored on the Pirate Bay. Now, what you could do is you could imagine, so I could see a case where you requiring a sort of stronger version of collision resistant, which is kind of halfway in between, where if you could find a meaningful collision, then what you could do is you could have a malicious version of your application, you could have a real version of your application. You could upload your real version of the application to BitTorrent, serve it up to the network, hundreds of people download it, and then they start thumbing up it because there's no malware, no one's virus, antivirus is going off, and then you could substitute in your malicious version and then own, like, whoever owns it, downloads it after that. Yeah, so you could, you should require actually strong collision resistance in that case. Now, in this case, your collision isn't between two truly random numbers that don't mean anything. It's what we call a meaningful collision. But that's actually the same as here in hash and sign. You want meaningful collision as well. So why don't we say we require CR as well? Good point. Any other questions? Yeah, sure. So there's two cases. So case one is you see someone that downloads a file that already exists. In that case, weak collision resistance is going to stop you from compromising it. The second case is you get to be the person that uploads the file, right? So you control, you get to choose this value. So it's not some value that you see that's given to you. You actually get to choose it, right? And in that case, if you can choose this and choose some chunk that would hash to the same thing, then yeah, you could serve up the good chunk for a while until everyone thinks it's good and then substitute in the bad chunk. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay, so the next thing we're going to do is we're going to note something. So a secure hash function means PR and CR and technically it means only that. Okay, so if you have some hash function that does weird things but it is PR and it is CR, then it's technically secure, okay? But when we think about hash functions, we like to think of it as like the output's completely random. It's like flipping a bunch of coins, okay? So there could be hash functions that sort of fall in the cracks of they exhibit weird behavior where they're not like flipping coins, but technically that weird behavior doesn't break PR and it doesn't break CR. Therefore, they're secure, okay? And so there's one example of sort of weird behavior that is not explicitly disallowed, but you would think shouldn't be possible, okay? And so it's what we call non-malleability. So I should say example of property not achieved. Okay, this is going to sound really wacky. I'll read it. It probably won't make much sense, but I'll give you an example, which would clarify it. Okay, So I give you an output of a hash, but I don't tell you the input. Can you find out the input? Not directly. Okay, pre-image resistant, we can't find it. Okay. What should be impossible is if I have the output h of x, I shouldn't be able to compute a sort of related output. Okay, if I don't know what x is and I have no idea what x is, I shouldn't even be able to compute, for example, the hash of x plus 1. Okay, so if you give me the hash of x, I don't know what x is, could I take that y and somehow kind of add 1 to y so that it ends up being the hash of x plus 1 even though I don't know what x is? Okay, so like, for example, if you think of this as kind of like your salary, so the hash of your salary, you have no idea what your salary is. You should have it. Maybe it's your proposed new salary. Say they're in a database or whatever, it's hashed. There should be no way for you to add 100K to your salary, right? And even though, but without knowing what that number was in the first place, okay? And if you can do that, we call it malleable. So malleable, you can think of it as, this is kind of like protected inputs, okay? Because you hashed it. It's not technically encrypted, okay? But this same property we're going to see with encryption, which is if you have an encrypted value, you have no idea what it decrypts to, you shouldn't be able to double it under encryption and say, okay, well, here's that value. I have no idea what it is still, but this is that number doubled, okay? So you shouldn't be able to double things or add numbers to them or add things onto the end of them or add things to the front of them, okay? So a hash, when you have the hash of something and you don't know what that x is, it should be secret and you shouldn't be able to kind of tweak it, okay? You shouldn't be able to change that value of x in a kind of known or structured way, okay? So I denote that as applying a function to x, okay? That's sort of a very general way of thinking about it. But some examples I could give you would be, you could compute the hash of x plus 1. The hash of 2x, right? The hash of, I'm just going to turn these all into lowercase. Hash of x with some number added on. Yeah, like a salt or something like that. Okay, so we would expect that a hash function probably wouldn't behave this way, right? If its outputs are just random, if they are random, if it's truly a random mapping, there's no way that this thing's happening, okay? But it turns out that because of the way the lower level details of how hash functions were designed, all hash functions on our list of secure hash functions, with the exception of SHA-3, they all actually are malleable. And specifically, they're malleable for this kind of attack, okay? So if you see a hash sitting there of some x and you have no idea what that x is, you can create the hash of that x with some digits added onto the end of it, okay? Even though you don't know what it is. And you can choose what those digits will be, okay? And you can replace it with it. And it turns out that this, even though it sounds kind of wonky, like, there are some real use cases where things can go really wrong with this kind of power to do, okay? So we're going to look at why it's the case. But before we look at why it's the case, we have to sort of take a look at how hash functions work on the inside, okay? And we're not going to go drop down to the lowest level detail. We're just going to drop down one sort of level of abstraction, okay? All right, so this, I'll just note, this is called a length extension attack. And it applies to MD5, SHA-1, and SHA-2, both variants. One requirement of SHA-3 was we don't want this property, okay? So all the SHA-3 candidates, one of the explicit requirements was get rid of this thing, We don't like it. So SHA-3 is structurally, not just this SHA-3, but all the candidates that were submitted, they're structurally different than these three things, which we'll see. So why is this vulnerable? Well, they're all based on this thing called Merkle-Damgaard. Merkle-Damgaard are two people, and they designed this thing, and then this is based on a sponge construction. Yeah. Without the help of the hash function?
Yeah.
You mean like if you don't know the specification of the hash function? Yeah, okay. So I didn't explain this very well. What we're doing here is we're not adding them together. What we're doing is we're concatenating them together. So remember, the input of a hash function can be any size. It can be infinite. So what we're doing is, when we take this file, we're taking chunk 1, we're sticking chunk 2 on the end, then chunk 3, and then chunk 4. Yeah? Now, if you added them, it is vulnerable because you could change one chunk, and then you could change the other chunk by the same difference so that they added up to the same value. Yeah? So the way that you compose these chunks actually matters a lot. Is that your question or is it different? Yeah. A malicious version of the file itself, not without breaking, not without finding a collision. Yeah. Okay. And then I'll note here that what we're doing here is, I'll write it here because that's a good point, is this is chunk 1 concatenated with chunk 2, concatenated with chunk 3, concatenated with chunk 4. It's not like some sort of addition or something like that in order to compose it. Okay. So let's look inside a hash function. Okay. What we're going to do is, inside a hash function, is there's always this thing that's kind of like a mini hash function, okay? So we call it a compression function, and we're not going to look inside a compression function for a while, okay? We're just going to assume that this thing exists. It's called a compression function, and it's exactly the same as a hash function, okay? By exactly the same, I mean it's CR, and it's PR, thus it's WCR because it's CR as well, okay? So it's just like a hash function. The only difference in a compression function and a hash function is a hash function takes an infinite number of bits and maps it to a single fixed length output. This one's not going to take an infinite amount of bits. It's going to take up to twice the output size, okay? So if the output size of your compression function is 256 bits, then it will take two 256 bits or 512 bits as inputs. Okay, so it takes a fixed size input, it gives you a fixed size output. The input's bigger than the output, so it's 512 being squeezed down to 256. That's why we call it a compression function. A hash function is the same thing. A hash function is a CR, PR, WCR compression function, except for you could have more than 256 bits, or 512 bits. You could have gigabytes, okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to, assuming that we have this sort of fixed-sized kind of mini hash function, we're going to chain up a bunch of these things so that we can take in an infinite input, okay? And the way that we're going to do it is we're going to chain it up sort of chunk by chunk. So if you want to hash your entire hard drive, let's say, not your entire hard drive, say a thumb drive. Okay, so it's 8 gigabytes. You want to hash 8 gigabytes. It's not like the hash function itself accepts inputs of 8 gigabytes. Okay, that would never work. It would never work in memory. It would be disastrous. Okay, so the way a hash function works is chunk by chunk. So it will take in the first chunk, which might be 256 bits. It will do something with it. It will get sort of an intermediate value. Then it will take the next 256 bits, mix it in. And then it will take the next 256 bits, mix it in. And then eventually you'll reach the end of your file and then it will quit. Okay? So that's how hash functions are able to handle an infinite size input, is that they work chunk by chunk. And so they break it off, okay? And the way that what you're going to do with each chunk is you're basically going to feed it into this compression function, okay? So you're going to have a bunch of these compression functions that are wired up. You're going to take in 256 message, mix it with the output of your previous compression function, output it. So this feeds into the next compression function. You pull in another 256 bits. That's sort of how it's going to work. So we'll draw that out, but that's the key idea, okay? So here's my 8 gigs of data. Okay, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take it in chunk by chunk. And let's just be concrete. So we'll say that this is 256 bits. This is the next 256 bits. Okay. I'll just denote it on the first one. So this is the input. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this, I'm going to feed it into one of these compression, these 2-to-1 compression functions. Okay, I'm going to get the output. And the idea is I'm going to feed the output into the next one. And I'm going to pull in the next block. Okay, and I'm going to get some output, and then that output is going to be, the final output will be just the output of the hash function. So we'll call it y, where y equals the hash of x. Okay, now we have two problems. The first problem is these compression functions take two inputs and feed out one. And so for this one, it's the previous compression function and the chunk. Here it's the previous one and the chunk. But for this one, there is no previous one. Okay? We have to start somewhere. Okay? So we have a problem here, which is what do we put in to the first time? Because we don't have a previous chunk. Okay, so we'll call that problem one. And then problem two is what if our file is not exactly a multiple of 256 bits, right? What if it kind of fills up two full blocks and then it kind of fills up, you know, here, so this is sort of the end of file. Okay, then we have to do something on the end here. The compression function is expecting explicitly 256 bits of input. Okay, and similarly, if let's say that your input was even 256 bits to start with, let's say you want to hash the bit one, right? Then you would have one block, it would take up one bit of this first block, and then you have the rest of the block, and you have to do something with it, okay? So this is our second problem. Okay. So issue one, what we're going to do is we're just going to pick a number and fix it for the hash function. So it's called an IV or initialization vector. It's It's chosen by NIST. So NIST just says, you know, if you use SHA-256, this first value is always, you know, 1-0-0-1-1-1-0-0-0-1-1-1. Okay? And they do put a little science into how they pick it. It's not completely arbitrary, but it's basically some number, and SHA-256 always has this number sitting there. It's just a constant that's given to you from on high from NIST. Okay? So that's how we deal with that. Okay? The second issue, what we need to do is we need to do padding. Okay? So we have to pad out the message. Now, padding turns out to be really tricky to get right. The reason it's tricky is, let's consider just an arbitrary case. What's the simplest padding? The simplest padding is we just add a bunch of zeros. Okay? So let's go back to the example where we're hashing just one. So if we pad it, we're going to get one with a bunch of zeros that will fill up the first block. Okay? We'll run that through the function with our IV, and we'll get some output. Okay? So that's what the hash of 1 looks like. Now, let's say I want to hash the value 10. Is the value 10 different than the value 1? First of all, it is a different input. Okay? What about the output? Is the output the same? It's the same, right? Because you'll take 10, right? Then you'll add enough zeros to fill up this thing. And so you'll add up with the exact same value sitting here. The IV is the same. This is deterministic, just like a hash function. So the output's the same. Bravo, you just found a collision. Okay, that's not collision resistant. The hash of 1 and the hash of 10 hash to the same value. You can't have that. Okay, so choosing padding is actually more challenging than it seems. Okay, so challenging that we're not going to talk about it now. We'll talk about it next class. Okay, so I'll take any questions you have offline because I think we're out of time. Thanks.